Donovan, you're going to find that we do a lot of friendly ribbing.
That's fine. I understand. All right. Welcome, everyone, to the Reflex Blue Show. I'm your host, Donovan Beery, and I feel like I'm in a bar here, even though I think we're in three bars because we're all remote or something like that. But I'm with two designers walk into a bar, and that's the podcast or what you actually go by. Maybe you don't even have real names. I'm not sure. It says something about Elliot Strunk and Todd Coates, but I'm not positive that's actually correct.
No, I wouldn't be positive of anything involving the two of us, Donovan.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we're actually in the same bar, but you're seeing two different vantage points within the same bar. So,
yeah, you get to see us, which means you're sitting in between Elliot and me, which is really not the best place to be.
That's right. When the fists start flying, you're going to be in the line of fire.
Okay, well, as long as you're picking up the tab, I can deal with this for the next half hour or so. So,
yeah, Todd, you heard that, right?
Here we go again.
I'll just mysteriously disappear and my bill will be there. You know? Oh, okay. I don't know.
Donovan, you're my ride home. So yeah, whenever you want to leave, you just say the word.
I'm used to okay. Elliot. No.
Where are you guys located down in, by the way? I'm not even sure. I'm here in Omaha and it's actually a little chilly today, but it's starting to feel like spring.
We're in a pastoral and balmy North Carolina.
Yes. Elliot is in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I'm located just outside of Raleigh, North Carolina.
Oh, so you guys, and you guys, we're here because Two Designers Walk Into a Bar.com is your podcast. So you guys record all of these remote then?
Yeah, we do some in-person events. So we have done some stuff where we've gotten together. We're going to try to get together some more moving forward. It's just, you know, we are two working designers. And so, you know, there are always considerations with that in terms of how we make schedules work.
And how do you guys consider your podcast? Because, you know, I've listened to an episode. It sounds great. You guys do a lot of research on this stuff, unlike myself, who just kind of starts recording things and then figures out what we're doing midway through.
Well, it's obvious if you're willing to talk to us, you've done next to no research, at least for this episode.
All right, well, that tracks.
Yeah, you seem to be doing a lot of things really right, Donovan, which thank you for having us today. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to have a conversation. But yeah, you're right. Both Elliot and I, we started this idea because we're like you, pop culture junkies. And we started, you know, we were playing that like, hey, did you know this did that and that did this? And that was the lawyer for this. And, you know, it was like there's the behind the music for the pop culture scene. So we just said, you know, someone else may want to know this stuff besides us.
Yeah. I mean, Todd and I are 10 years apart in age, but we definitely ate at the same trough of pop culture content growing up. So the way the podcast started was during COVID, we were having a conversation because one of our favorite illustrators, Mort Drucker, for Mad Magazine, had passed away. He was what, Todd, 90 or in his early 90s? So he passed away, and we were just both talking about how much we loved Mad Magazine growing up and how we would trace over and try to mimic his illustration style when we were doing our own drawings. And we just got to talking about other things we loved, like the movie Airplane. That's our favorite movie. And so just this idea of humor and pop culture and shared sensibility. And after about half an hour or so of just having this conversation where we were walking down memory lane, it just struck me. I was like, you know, we can't be the only two people in the world, the only two designers, the only two creative people who are talking about Mort Drucker today. And are there other people out there who we could commiserate with, connect with, whatever? And so when you think about that idea of facts coupled with humor, coupled with approachability, a bar seemed to be this sort of logical setting where you'd have the confluence of all those things coming together. And so since there's two of us, that's how the name came about.
Actually, our whole podcast was that we would sit around and, you know, way back in the day, way back, Nate would sit around and just, it was just be me and Tom and Nate and stuff. We'd be talking in the bar and he'd be like, this is the whole podcast. We're like, what? He's like, let's talk about design in a bar. So, and so that was the whole, when we started, that was our whole inspiration, but it wasn't even talking about pop culture stuff. It was just talking about whatever designers talk about.
And, you know, I think so. We were listening to some of your recent episodes, the one on Tad Carpenter and the one Kit Heinrichs, when you were talking to him about his book. And Todd and I are both collectors, you know, talking about Kit Heinrichs and one of the subjects you brought up with him. Like, I collect letter E's for Elliot. If you remember the Shmaev and Geismar Best store logo, the B-E-S-T that grows, I have about a 9-foot E in my backyard, actually.
Nice.
In front of a Best store. Todd was actually with me. Todd and I have been partners in crime for a long time. When I lived in Raleigh, Todd and I used to live in the same city. And when I lived there, I had a 6-foot E in my apartment. And Todd, I was thinking about this today, that ended up being a prop in a photo shoot that you pulled together for a photographer in Raleigh.
I was doing a photo shoot. We used you and your apartment and your giant E as a prop.
Do you remember?
The apartment, I think, is about 6 foot by 6 foot, too. So it took up a space.
Do you remember? I'd forgotten about this. Alphabets. And
yeah.
We made all the alphabets because there aren't, you know, alphabets, as we found out after opening the box. Apparently, it's more than just the letter E in alphabets. Okay. I have a letter in the post. They have not yet responded. So we had to, like, take X-Acto knives and cut up, like, B's and similar letters and make a bunch more E's out of it so we could have those in the bowl.
That was a stroke of genius. And then a dear friend of both of ours who lived near Elliot at the time had the line of the night. You want to share what that was, Elliot?
Oh, well, which one? I mean,
Okay. So Charlie was, he's probably 10, 15 years older than me, probably 25 years older than Elliot. Just wonderful, wonderful human, never short of commentary. And he was helping me cut the ends off of B's to make them E's. And he was like, well, here we are, graphic designer and an old queen fighting over an X-Acto blade.
I forgot about that. Yeah, Charlie was a dear friend to both of us. He was absolutely hilarious.
You always wonder when those X-Acto knife skills are going to come in handy. And now you know.
Yeah.
In the bar when you're fighting over who's going to pay the tab or when you're cutting up breakfast cereal.
That's right.
It's funny how much we end up using them, the X-Acto knives. And before I went to school, I don't know if I really, for design school, I'm like, I never thought to cut paper with them. Why would you do that? Why would you ever do that?
No, I was just going to say, you know, you've got scissors. So why do I need a knife? Giving elementary school kids X-Acto knives and saying, this is how you do it.
But are you guys surprised that not more people within our respective classes of design school didn't impale themselves or cut off a digit or something with those? Because, I mean, we weren't at our best selves a lot of those hours either.
You're high on a spray fixative and, you know, paint fumes and rubber cement and whatever else. Yeah. And sleep battled, right? You hadn't slept in a day or two, probably.
I'm going to have to put links to what spray mount is and fixative is in this episode for the young kids.
Hey, you can just spray that in a bag and breathe it.
Yeah. So, spray fix is like command save for analog.
for two pieces of paper. Two pieces of paper.
I still use the X-Acto knife quite a bit, but honestly, the spray adhesive I haven't used in a couple of years.
It's all in your lungs. It's still all in your lungs.
Yeah. You're like the graphic design version of a coal miner.
Yeah, I guess it's mainly because we'd always present. You'd have to spray everything onto your map board and to get it all nice and presented. And you still cut things out because you want it to look good. But I haven't presented in boards in a while. You just hand someone the sheet or lay it on the table.
Yeah, PDF if it's remote, right? You just, you go through a slideshow and you load it up on online for them to download at some point or email it to them or whatever. You know, the other thing I wanted to return to also mentioned Tad Carpenter. And, you know, he talked a lot about play and this idea of play and that there's joy in that, in this idea of reminding himself through his work why he got into design in the first place when you're feeling burnout or frustration or whatever. And so going back to the research piece of what we do, that is so fun, I think, for Todd and I, because it reminds us of all these creative touch points that we had growing up, all these things that we loved and that we still love. And so one of the core motivations for having these conversations, doing the research and having these conversations, is we get to share this joy with other people our age, older, who are thinking, oh yeah, I haven't thought about that in a while. Yeah, that's super cool. And then going back to the younger people, these folks who may or may not have grown up on a diet of some of these pop culture things, and it can only help, you know, it's always a good idea if you're a visual thinker, if you're helping shape culture, to know your roots, know where you came from, those sorts of things. And so for folks who maybe are used to digital mock-ups or a steady diet of stimulation, shall we say, through an Instagram feed or whatever, pausing, going offline, maybe seeking out at a flea market or a bookstore or a garage sale or whatever, these tangible physical things and being able to lay your hands on them, understand the scale, understand the materials, understand the print techniques that were used or whatever. There's a lot of joy in that too, right? It's okay as a creative thinker to press pause and also walk away from the screen, I think.
Ellie, that's the tangible thing too. Yeah. The intangible is, how did that thing get to someone's, from someone's brain to their hands? Go ahead.
Oh, you're totally fine. I was just going to say, when you do walk away though, you know, the good thing is you always have a podcast in your pocket to inspire you as you're walking around. So, you know, keep that in mind. You can be with us in the bar wherever you may go.
Oh, well, that's nice to know. I do think though, there is something where seeing the things in person, and like you say, it makes a difference, because even if you read comic books now online, they don't have the same paper, like the texture is a little bit different, and you don't quite understand like why something's like, how did this become popular? And sometimes when you see it in person, you're like, oh, that's different than I envisioned. The example I give is, we're working with, I'm teaching right now, where one of the projects is about scale, so they're doing a poster and a billboard.
Yes.
And so I bring in I've got the Milton Glaser Bob Dylan poster.
Yep.
And you're like, you see this in your book, and everyone, most designers have seen it. And I'm like, and you're like, hey, I get why that's cool. I get why that's popular. But then when you see it and it's 2 foot by 3 foot, it's a little bit different. And then you're like, this is why it became popular. Not because of, you know, this little JPEG, but it's a thing that hung on your wall and basically took up a huge chunk of it, and people just stared at it.
Yeah, is that part of
the one you bring in, does it actually have the fold lines from when it was in an album? Like, is it an original?
Yes. And I think it's framed. So I, you know, it's unfolded, but the lines are there. And I think I had someone's like, oh, how'd you get one? And it's like, well, they made like 6 million of these. I'm shocked I don't see more of them still.
I went to a flea market the other week and I saw one framed, and I was debating buying it. And it was like $10, you know, in a crummy frame or something. Yeah.
You should have bought that.
For me,
I can go back, it's still there.
I think for $10, you could just give it to a designer as a gift. No matter who they are, they would just take it and think that you're great. And it'd be like, you just keep it in your car and your trunk. And then if you like show up and one of your designer friends is like, it's your birthday. Oh, I got you something. And you just pull it out. Then it's a catch-all gift. If I saw one for $10, even if I have one, I'd buy another.
Yeah. You know, I can also get a Sharpie, and then it suddenly gets a lot more elevated when it becomes a signed Milton Glaser original. Todd, Christmas is coming eventually, and you just might get one of those.
Like that. But can I jump back to something you just said, Donovan? When you share that work with your students, so that's an element. You're sharing scale, of course, they don't get from a JPEG. And that's obviously, that's one of the things as designers and creators that we have in our toolbox to work with. And the other thing is context. Like, why was that poster such a big deal at the time? And, you know, we don't get that on Instagram or, you know, looking at Behance or something like that. It's just not there. So seeing that stuff live and in the wild, I think is really magical for designers.
And I also wonder, because it was in his greatest hits album, they obviously made more of them. If it was in one of the albums that didn't do as well, and there were, instead of 6 million, there was only like 500,000, it probably wouldn't have been as popular.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've done several episodes. You know, we had talked about Rock and Roll Over before we started recording. That was what, Todd? That was, I think, our second episode we recorded. Right? Yep. Our 1976 episode. And so even from the beginning, we knew the power of things like album art and this idea of adding a visual element to an audio medium, and that this idea of tangibility, because you, when you bought music, you had this physical thing. You had this, if you were very lucky, like in the case of Bob Dylan, you had a real poster that came inside of this record album. But even if you didn't have that, you still had a 12 by 12 miniature poster that you would pop on your headphones, put the album on the turntable, and just be staring at it while you're listening to this music for the first time and trying to figure it all out. So I think it's really a hand in glove relationship. And it's sort of sad, I think, to some degree, that that's kind of gotten lost. And I think that's why we've seen this resurgence with vinyl in the last several years.
Well, clearly people, well, it's not only that, obviously the art form, which is a 12 by 12, as you said, but it's the whole tactile experience. You're not just pushing a button at the beginning of the day and letting an algorithm figure out what you're going to hear. It's a ritual. It's a ceremony now. And that's caused the rise of vinyl.
I also think it makes you listen to all that B-sides. Sometimes you listen to a record and you're like, oh, I hear a bunch of crap because of it. You're not just hearing the hits. It's like you start it and you're like, oh, I'm going to listen to this whole album, regardless if I want to or not, because I'm too lazy to get up and go across the room and change it.
Yeah.
So I've got some singles, but man, putting those on vinyl is hard because you're like, man, you got to change that every like 3 minutes. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
You got to have one of those old, like when I was little, I had one of those turntables that had the little feeder.
Oh, yeah.
Pack a bunch of stuff and just drop it. So you just need one of those, man. You need to just, I see the turntable behind you there. You just need to see if that technology is.
I don't think they make that on any of the new turntables. I mean, I remember having one as a kid, but
yeah,
that's the one thing they just gave up on. They're like, no.
It wasn't just adapters, though.
45s?
There was just some of the old turntables before they quit making them and started making them again had like, it was like a stick that just came up from the middle. Yeah. And it would, and you could balance.
It was like, had a little wedge. It was like a spring loaded wedge. And when the needle, if I remember correctly, when the arm got to the center of a record, it would know it was at the center, and the movement of the arm would trigger, like the arm would move out of the way automatically. It would trigger this sequence where the next record would drop down, and then the arm would come back and just park itself at the beginning of that next record. I loved it when I was a little kid. Yeah.
It was obviously well enough known. I think I've got a couple double albums that were original, where they actually, the side B is on the second record. So you would stack both of them, it would play both in a row, and then you'd flip both of them over and it would play the other. And it's one of these things where I think that's one thing that gets lost. If I would have not known those existed, I'd be like, why are the A, B, C, D on these records in such a weird format? But it's so that it was built for those arms.
It's almost like print spreads versus reader spreads for records. Yeah.
Back in the day too, when you had a double album set and the whole gatefold thing, that was like manna from heaven. That was just not only twice as much work to look at, it was like four times as much. And then you can sort of unfold the story a little bit more. We actually, there's an episode we did about the famous Rolling Stones album cover with the zipper that Andy Warhol worked on, and crazy, all of the challenges that they faced and anyone would face if they're trying to do something that is really out of the norm.
Mm-hmm. Or the New Order single that Peter Saville designed, and it cost so much to make with all the die cuts and everything that the more factory records sold, the more money they lost. And it was the most popular 12 inch ever in the history of records.
Oh, jeez.
They just totally went in the hole because it got so popular. It's great.
Well, we're going to be right back with Todd and Elliot. Welcome back, everyone. Todd, I think, is getting up to, I mean, is Elliot, is this when we like leave him with the tab, or should we hang around a little bit? Oh, you he's know, back. Sorry.
Oh, well, let's pretend we never talked about this.
You know what? Fuck you both. Okay. I don't know what was said, but I'm sure that was the response. Thank you. You know,
Todd, we're just talking about how much we loved you, but if that's your attitude, that's fine with us. You know, whatever.
Doesn't sound familiar.
Now, you guys, how do you guys go around picking like what topics then? Like what's like for the next show? Do you guys have arguments over it, or do you just randomly say, like, I went to the flea market, I, you know, stumbled upon this old comic, I opened it up, I saw the ad for, you know, I was a 98-pound weakling, and then all of a sudden I started like,
right.
we watch Atlas.
We watch what you're doing, Donovan, and then we just copy that. Basically,
now that you're here, you're probably like, this guy does not do as much as we expected. I'm a little shocked, and we're obviously following the wrong person. But I appreciate it.
You actually hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's easy if you sit around with a buddy and just start talking about things and how they became famous things that you're familiar with. If you start pulling those threads, there's just so many pop culture devices that tie us all together. And we happen to have, you know, sort of both a love for the kitsch and the cool. Those things are endless. You know, there's tons of supply. Like you mentioned, the ads in the back of comic books. Who knew there was so much to learn about those?
Todd, can I confess to Donovan and our listeners here in the bar, our mutual addiction? Donovan, are we at the point in our relationship where Todd and I can kind of give you a peek inside the kimono?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm not sure if that's a euphemism for something, but...
No, I mean, I'm literally not wearing anything under this robe right now.
That's what I was kind of worried about.
Tell me we were wearing kimonos.
Yeah. Todd and I are both hopeless addicts of Wikipedia.
Yes, we are. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We've done several meetings. We're in support groups, but so far nothing's stuck, and we're shameless about it. I'm admitting this, Todd. I think we can finally come clean with everybody that we both love Wikipedia and all the rabbit holes it provides.
And Donovan, we lie to our wives and tell them we're watching porn instead of Wikipedia.
We're actually on Wikipedia.
Might be less embarrassing.
Not the way we do it.
Before I forget to ask, where do people go to follow you, both as designers? Like, not obviously they can go to your website for the podcast, but where do they go? Like, if people say, "Hey, I want to go check out their work, I want to follow what they're doing," where do you recommend?
What do you think, Todd? What should we recommend?
Well, I mean, it could be individual. We could start with Todd. Todd, where do people go to follow you?
Sure. So my website and all of my social is really easy. It's toddcoats.com and at Todd Coates. I publish a lot on Instagram because I like seeing that no one else sees my work. I think that's really important. So I do that a lot. But I try to keep busy by creating a lot of work, and I put it out there just as a record, mainly for anything. Elliot, you have multiple ways of people to track you.
I do creative strategy work for an agency called Honestly. So that's honestly.co. I also have a design firm called Studio H. That website is made by studioh.com. I also do fine art collage work. And, you know, for anyone who follows us, two designers, you start to see some of that aesthetic blend over into our episode art and things like that. And that's mixed results. So on Instagram, that's like mixed results collage. And then it's the website is mixed-results.com. And you can see some of the collage work. So, and then we're, you know, Todd and I are on all the usual places like LinkedIn and that sort of thing. So
what got you into collages originally? Was it just because you have all this garbage around your house and you're like, I need to start getting rid of this? Like, or is it an excuse? Like, I need to buy more stuff. And if I say I'm doing collages, it's great. Cause that's not a bad idea. I might start using that.
Those sound like really good reasons to me.
Yeah. So Todd, do you want me to move in so you can buy more stuff and I can get rid of your garbage?
You just answer the man's question, Ellie.
Yeah. Sorry. We could only talk about one addiction at a time, apparently, Donovan. But for me, collage, I've always been interested in collage. I've always loved collage. And just like the podcast, really COVID kicked it in a high gear. We started our podcast during COVID. I started collage work in earnest during COVID. And it really came down to going back to what we were saying earlier, this idea of the tactile, the offline, doing things with your hands. I would literally go around, find all kinds of things that were beaten up, textured, funky, whatever. And I'd pick them up and just start putting them together for therapy, really, if nothing else. And then once I had a little bit of a body of work, I thought, well, what can I start to do with this? How can this be a learning opportunity? The only gallery experience I ever had was related to things like alumni shows or design award shows or whatever. You're just sort of taking something you had done and putting it in a frame. It really, you weren't the one necessarily organizing the show or anything like that. So I have been very fortunate enough that I showed my work to a local gallery here that's a co-op, and they admitted me into the gallery, and I've been able to have a couple shows there and some other solo shows around town, and just really plugging into another network of people and learning how fine art works. And whenever I tell people I'm a designer with my day job, they look at the collage and they always nod their head and they say, yeah, I could totally see that, because things tend to be gridded or they tend to be type driven or things like that. You know, I think they're fairly unstructured, but other people look at them and be like, nah, there's definitely some structure going on there.
It's a lot of, as a designer, you spend a lot of work trying to make it look unstructured, which probably people pick up on it wasn't just by happenstance is what I mean.
So one of my favorite designers when I first got into design school was and is David Carson. And I grew up skateboarding, and I unknowingly had always liked his work when he had art directed Trans World Skateboarding back in the 80s, you know, when no one knew who he was because he hadn't yet done Beach Culture, certainly hadn't done Ray Gun. So that always stuck with me over the years. And then obviously his other work. And then I've always, a couple other designers I liked, still like Vaughn Oliver, who passed away a few years ago. I have books from him. I adore his work he did for 4AD Records and everything. It's just a beautiful blend of the typographic and the organic and the layered. Like, his work is sublime, I think. And then Mike McQuaid, a more contemporary example. I love his collage work and how illustrative it is. He's an incredible, incredible talent. So for anyone listening who may not know who, I'm sure people know who David Carson is. He's sort of the household name, right? He's the Michael Jordan or Tony Hawk of design. But if you don't know who Vaughn Oliver was, or if you don't know who Mike McQuaid is, please look both of these people up, because their work is absolutely incredible.
And Todd, what's your type of design work that you do?
So I didn't know this. When I went to graduate school, I wanted to be a teacher. And the very first day we brought in our books, and a fellow student called me a designistrator. And that, you know, I think that fits. I grew up drawing. I still draw almost every day. It's a compulsion to make stuff, you know? And my work was a combined thing where it's telling the conceptual story that design can carry through. And then it's also treating it in a little bit of a funky, interesting, very tactile way. Like the designers that I responded to, I still am big into concept. So the designers from Pentagram, like Paula Shears, one of my heroes, her husband, Seymour Quast, who is obviously from Pushpin and Milton Glaser, these guys that grew up drawing and then started drawing letters and, you know, making logos out of faces and things like that. And Woody Pirtle from back in the Dallas days, all these guys, Fred Woodward from Rolling Stone days and Texas Monthly. But I love the folks that no matter what elements they're using, it not only physically conveys a message through the content, but it also aesthetically conveys the concept through, you know, the look, the texture, the feel, the hard part of it, you know, is what is that intangible thing, that doesn't make sense, but you see it and you're like, okay, I get what this is about.
Fred Woodward, when he was at Rolling Stone. So this is another thing that's pretty unfortunate is, and Todd and I have talked about this too, we both came of age. I started design school in the fall of 1991, graduated spring of 95. And that was really the birth of the internet, you know, the very nascent internet, you know, Netscape Mosaic and web crawler on AOL, as awful as that was. And so that was peak magazine, right? That's when Ray Gun was out. That's when Wired debuted, you know, with all its fluorescent inks and metallics and varnishes and everything overlapping. And Rolling Stone was this big oversized publication with amazing photography and beautiful typography that worked so well together. And I feel very, very fortunate, going back to what Todd said, that I came of age and sort of cut my teeth in this time when there was so much high quality, incredible visual stimulus. Just to, you could just walk into a bookstore and just go to the magazines, which I always did, and just start picking them up and looking through them. And you would just get so excited. Like, I would just be vibrating to go start that next project after seeing all of this inspiration in print. Like Todd said, he wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to be Fred Woodward. I wanted to be David Carson. I wanted to art direct a magazine. That's, you know, be Plunkett and Kerr from Wired with what they were doing. That was kind of my North Star at the time. And I had some magazine internships when I was in college and worked at the school newspaper. And so this idea of a deadline when you had these, and I think that's why one of the things, at least for me personally, why I enjoy a podcast, because much like a magazine or much like a newspaper or whatever, even though it's not a printed thing, it is sort of like a periodical. It's delivering information. You have subscribers. There is a cadence to it. And so you're sort of forced to make some of these decisions because you have to put something out by a deadline, even if it's a self-imposed deadline. And I think that's really for, you know, younger people listening, that's really one of the things. If you want to take your idea from a notion in your head to maybe something that's sketched on paper to something that becomes this reality in some way, give yourself a schedule. And maybe like what Todd and I do, have a partner, because as partners, we hold one another accountable for, we have a workflow and we each have certain distinct responsibilities as part of our workflow, even though we share things like the topics we cover and the research we do and we record at the same time. But then once a recording is baked, we have very specific responsibilities when we hand things off to one another to get to the final artifact that you hear and the web page that you see and the social media posts that you digest. And so I personally love that cadence that comes from that. And so I think maybe to some degree, sort of closing the circle here, doing the podcast is almost scratching that same magazine itch that I had over 30 years ago. I never thought about that till just now, though.
Yeah, it makes sense. I didn't think about that either, but it is kind of the same thing. We're digging into some stories that you didn't know would be interesting stories, and telling those stories, hopefully in a way that other people will want to hear them, learn something from it.
You forget until you revisit things like how influential something was, or you start to look at it, you know, years later, you start to think about it in different aspects and you're like, oh, that's different. In design, you know, we take all these ideas and come up with solutions. Sometimes I'm assuming you've found some that you've visited some old items and you realize that that might help with the solution I've been looking for some, you know, weird banner ad that I've been working on or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's this notion that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, right? There's this, the human condition, and there's only like so many things that are happening. And so, yeah, you can always, I always approach problem solving from the perspective of, I'm not the first person in the world to have this problem. So when other people encountered it in the past, what did they do to solve it? Like, where did they go? What were they looking at? What did that solution look like? And even with the podcast, I mean, Todd and I, we're very fortunate. We're on a podcast network. Thank you, Evergreen Podcasts. But we're largely self-taught. We're still figuring this out. We're building the plane as we're flying it. I mean, you know, Donovan, you've done this many, many more years than we have, and we have a lot of respect for you as a result of that. And I'm sure that you probably wish you had a dollar for every mistake and wrong turn you made over your podcast career, right?
Oh, I don't even think about that. You just keep moving on and it's the next show. And then, you know, I'll forget, you know, it's like, oh, I think I might've done that before, but I forget. So you just keep moving. My goal is just whenever anyone asks me, my only two real advices that I give them is spend like $100 on a microphone. You'll sound better. And find a format and a topic that will entertain yourself. Because if you're not entertained, right, you'll just quit doing it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's like any creative endeavor. If the passion, if you're not putting the passion into the work will suffer. So yeah. It's like stick with it. And to go back to your question about topics, where do we find our topics? Todd and I have a Google Doc that is a laundry list of topics, because whenever we talk about something, we'll, you know, we try to say to ourselves, well, okay, well, this is an interesting topic. Has it been talked about to death? Like, so I would say if we have any criteria for what we choose to talk about, we'll sort of take a look at maybe what other podcasts are doing or whatever exists in the world related to this specific topic. And we'll sort of hold one another to account and we'll say, is there anything unique that we can add to this subject that hasn't already been discussed, whether it's our unique take on it or maybe an interesting pop culture or historical aspect that we've uncovered that isn't really out there in sort of, you know, pop culture that like your average armchair enthusiast would know? Because if we feel there are lots of things we would love to talk about that we genuinely love from design history, pop culture history, whatever, but there's nothing, they've been talked to death. There's nothing to really add to them. So as much as we would love to have that be part of our list of topics, we're not really sure what additional value we can provide.
Oh, no. You just got to drive that into the ground. You just got to keep just jam it in there and just throw it down someone's throat and just be like, I know you know all this, but we're just going to repeat it over and over and over again.
And, you know, we find because of our love of looking for those threads that tie things together, you know, we find all these connections, not just within like the same Mad Magazine people also created Wacky Packages and Garbage Pail Kids, but also just, I think there's these coincidences of dates. And I'll give you a real quick, for instance, Donovan. So Elliot and I did a series on pop art, and the godfather of that is Andy Warhol. There's probably never been another human that has documented their life as much as Andy Warhol did. So we were kind of like, all right, well, what do you do? What do we say here? And then at one point we were talking about the very first show where he displayed the Campbell soup cans. And it was a horrible show. He sold 5 pieces. The gallery owner ended up buying them all back because he wanted to keep them. But the dates were the fun thing. Sorry, there's my dog deciding.
Let the dog in the bar.
Yeah.
Go.
What kind of bar are you taking me to?
Oh, really? It's dog.
Yeah. Print. Yeah. Oh. Okay. That's fine. Mine might be here too, but I think he's in the back room.
So it's a dog eat dog bar out there.
Yeah.
So what I was going to say is as we started digging, Jesus,
Charlie, go run somewhere else.
Anyway, as we started digging into the dates, we realized that Andy's very first show on the West Coast of the soup cans was the exact day that the very first Walmart opened. You know, cosmic coincidence. And here's one, the day the show closed, a disastrous show, was the very day that Marilyn Monroe died. So it was that day when he was like, okay, I'm going to go paint pictures of Marilyn Monroe. And that we wouldn't know Andy Warhol if it wasn't for that. So those little things, I think, are just magical when you start putting yourself into that time frame and realizing all these things may be connected in some way.
With all of our planning and all of our thinking, sometimes just weird happenstances are what makes things take off or not.
I mean, I'm a huge believer in just sort of make sure that your quote unquote radio is tuned to the right frequency for like humor and weirdness and whatever. And the universe will always provide something for you, right? You just have to sort of be a vessel to receive it. But yeah, going back to why do we talk about the things we do? Why do we do the research we do? You know, Todd, I would say another thing that you love is a good old fashioned scandal.
And gosh, yeah.
Todd's our design legal on the design legal beat for us. I don't know if listeners are aware of that, but if there's a scandal, we'll uncover it. And Todd will usually do his best to exploit it. Todd, you're not known as the Maury Povich of design for nothing.
That's right. I am the tea spiller of our podcast. I will tell some drama on it.
Well, I love it. And Elliot, Todd, I really got to thank you for your time. And everyone check out Two Designers Walk Into a Bar. Todd pays the bill. We're all good. So.
Yeah, which reminds me, Donovan, you've left your car running outside, right? Like, well, Todd, we need to go to the bathroom.
Todd, we'll be right back. We'll be right back, Todd.
Yeah.
Here we go. Thanks, Donovan. It's great talking with you.
The Reflex Blues Show with Donovan Meary is hosted at 36point.com. Music by Dust Lab.